I've been running on Diet Coke and fumes for like 3 weeks now, sitting on the edge. So I'm wired, which means no holds barred tonight. Best evidence, 10 of the best UFO sightings. There's 10 cases there, folks, and if you can disprove 9 of them, guess what? You're still left with one unidentified flying object case that you can't disprove. And in that case, you should be taking it seriously. It's an unexplainable case. Nobody's been able to crack it yet. I've dropped clues, but I've never given the top 10 list. So here it is.
Kimball of Canada.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of our little audio program here. It's not really been All of America Audio this week. It's not even on the usual time of the week. It's that special. It's Kimball of Canada Audio, and we're going to be talking about Paul Kimball's big special that is premiering by the time you're listening to this. Hopefully we can coincide the premiere dates, and on Thursday you'll be listening to this and getting ready to watch it if you're in Canada. The special is Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings, and it's going to be on Canada's Space, the Imagination Station, Thursday, May 10th at 9 p.m., there's the big rundown there. And we were teasing this in the baseball special about a month ago, and we got it together here, and hopefully you'll notice the fancy layout at the website for Kimball of Canada. And we're going to rock and roll right now with the Kimball of Canada Behind the Best Evidence special. So welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be back. I was going to say I'm been all of America, but it's been a tough slog. You've made me smile. Thank you very much. To be on Kimball of Canada for one night only, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, that's what makes it special here. We're breaking the mold out of the weekly setup, and I want to make it something over-the-top sort of special. So it's Kimball of Canada, one night only, as you said. Well, let's talk about the big special. You've been talking about it quite a bit, but it just got wrapped up, as you indicated. So Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings, it's in the can. It's ready to roll out by the time people are listening to this audio. For starters, let's get the actual Top 10 officially announced. Can we do that?
Sure. Drum roll.
You have not given it out at all yet, so it is kind of an exclusive, right?
No, I think during the baseball special I told you, it's like trying to figure out where the Simpsons live. If you watched every episode of the Simpsons and a team of grad students did it, and you listened to all the clues, you could figure out what state they're in. Somebody figured that out once. I've dropped clues here and there in my blog and on radio shows and stuff as to what cases might be on. But I've never given the top 10 list. So here it is. First time, probably going to be on space, but the first time besides space on radio. Number 10, Nuremberg, 1561. Number 9, Skylab 3 case from 1973. The number 8 case, is the Yukon mass witness sighting from 1996. Number 7 is the Malmstrom Air Force Base case from 1967. Number 6 is good old Shag Harbor from Canada, 1967 as well. Number 5 is the Santa Barbara Channel case, often known as the Kelly Johnson case, from 1953 in the United States. Number 4 is the McMinnville case, the Trent photographs from 1950. Number 3 is the Rendlesham Forest case from 1980, sometimes known as the RAF Bentwaters case. Number 2 is the Tehran case from 1976, the Iranian fighter jet case. And number 1, the number 1 case for all you wrestling fans at home, is the RB-47 case from 1957 over, well, the Gulf of Mexico, Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, and Oklahoma. It took place over all of those states. So there it is. There's the top 10 UFO sightings of all time.
Wow. Is it nice to get that out of the way, that you've been holding on to the secret for so long?
I hold on to a lot of secrets, Tim.
Oh,
so
no.
That's just the one that I got out of the way tonight. It is weird. It is weird to actually talk to somebody who's not in sort of the inner Red Star circle or whatever. I can count maybe on, two hands, the number of people who know what the top 10 cases were. It included Brad Sparks, who was our lead consultant. Obviously, the people who worked in post-production, so the online editor and the sound guys would know. Chris McBride knew because she was narrating, of course. My brother knew. My co-producer, Jim Kimball, knew. But, you know, beyond that, maybe two other people. So probably, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10. Guys like Stan Friedman didn't know what they were. Bruce McAbee, even though they're in the film, and they would know that I asked them about a certain number of cases. They wouldn't know what the final 10 were, nor would they know, even if they did, what order it came in. Because when I interviewed people, I would ask them about a range of cases, because at the time I interviewed, for instance, Dr. McAbee back in June of 2006, we didn't have the final top 10 list yet. So I was pretty sure, for instance, McMinnville was going to be on it. McMinnville was sort of ranking high as the votes, as it were coming in. And McAbee's sort of one of the experts on McMinnville, so I talked to him about that. But I also talked to Bruce about the New Zealand case, the 1978, I think it was 78 New Zealand case, because that was sort of in the top 20 and bouncing around, and it might have slid in at number 10 or something. So I wanted to make sure that I had all the bases covered. But yeah, it was a small group of people who knew, and now it's a larger group of people who know. So yeah, it does feel good to get it off my chest, so to speak.
This is how, just to take people inside the making of the special, this is how secretive Paul was. He sent me the list of cases, and then I was sort of in the, I was on the fringe of the inner circle. And then, now as he's read them, I have the list of cases he sent me. And as he's read them, I've had to put the numbers beside them because they're all mixed up. So I've got like a little Orphan Annie code sheet here on the top 10 cases.
Well, it's one of the things, it is weird and it sounds crazy and goofy, but one of the things that in Canada Space is, if you're going to do a top 10 countdown film, you'd like at least the first time that the cases are rolled out for it to be a surprise.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, what's the point? So, Space has never said anything to me about all the little hints I've been dropping. I don't even think, you know, maybe they don't know I've been doing it. They might not be voracious readers of my blog or various, UFO message boards, but that was for promotional purposes. But you know, they never told me. There's no written agreement between the network and me saying you cannot reveal the top 10 list beforehand, but it's kind of an unwritten rule that you don't go out and sort of spill the beans before it actually goes on air.
Exactly.
Having said that, even if I had, people would know what the top 10 were and what order they were in, but they wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't know what witnesses might be popping up or what experts are going to, you know, what's in the synopses of the cases. And there are, you know, some surprises there, too. So there you go.
Let me get this out of the way first. I keep calling them cases, but the special says top 10 UFO sightings. Is that just sort of a way they titled the special? Because some of these aren't really sightings. That Skylab one's not necessarily a sighting.
Well, you know, the guy sighted it from the Skylab station and took photos of it. So I hate to admit it, but originally the film was called Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Cases. And someday it will probably be called that again when I maybe re-edit the opening credits. However, the animators who did the opening credits sequence and all the animation in the film and did a wonderful job for the most part, they got it wrong. So
oh, wow.
The credit sequence came in, I don't know what, 2-3 days ago, and it had best, maybe four, I can't remember, and it had Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings. And I hadn't picked up before when they had sent me logos that sightings was on there instead of cases. You know, I just sort of looked, oh, it looks cool. I get 20 other things to do, and
yeah.
I didn't see it. This time I saw it, and I went, that's not right. But, you know, it was too late to really go back and say, can you redo that entire opening credit
yeah.
sequence for me, boys? And the other thing is, sightings, cases, I didn't think that that was, you know, a particularly significant difference, because they are all sightings.
Yeah.
Even as you, the Skylab cases you talk about, was cited by people. So there's always people in these cases. They don't exist in a vacuum. So sightings is a perfectly valid thing to use there. But I will admit on Kimball of Canada that, or for future reference, Banal of America, that, yeah, that it was not planned that way. So that was a little, that's one of those bloopers on the outtake reel that you talk about on the director's commentary on the DVD, you know.
There you go. Well, this is almost that. If, for the people in Canada who can see the show, this is almost a neat little supplement for them, so hopefully they check it out.
There you go. It's almost like calling Star Wars Star Battles at the, you know, at the final, and Lucas lets it go. So, you know, that's what I did.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to, I was kind of just busting your chops, but something did, I guess, stick out about that, because maybe it was just because we've done interviews before, and I was like, why is it this title now? I could have sworn it was Cases, and why do I keep calling them Cases? And so I'm glad I'm not going crazy, at least.
No, you're not. And they are Cases, and it's my legal background. You know, I refer to things as cases, and they are cases, and it's a question of evidence and all that sort of stuff. And when you use a phrase like best evidence, it links into cases. To me, it's the way I'm trained to think of things. However, most people, frankly, view them as UFO sightings. You know, people are out in the backyard or whatever, or wherever they are, and they see a UFO. Now, to UFO researchers, that becomes a case. But it's a distinction without a difference? Something like that, whatever that saying is. You know, there's no real difference there, so no harm, no foul.
Yeah, I was just kind of busting your chops.
This is what we're going to be doing all night, folks. We're going to be telling you exactly how I screwed up everything in the film, every single thing.
Oh, no. Well, let's talk about how the special came about in the first place. Let's go back to the beginning. This is when I was looking at the blog and the Other Side of Truth blog to do my research on the special here. I see that it's been sort of a year-long process. So let's talk about that original germination of this big special that's coming up tonight.
Sure. I think originally Space licensed it, and the way it works, for those of you not in the television biz, in Canada at least, is the network, in this case Space, pre-licenses. They buy it in advance for a license fee. So Space gets exclusive rights in Canada for a year and then 3 years of non-exclusive rights, and they'll be airing it 18 times over 4 years. I use that money to leverage other money excuse me, from various government sources. So it takes a while to raise the funding, the total budget. That process started in 2005. So the film is really almost a year and a half, 2 years old. I was supposed to deliver, frankly, according to the original contract, I think in December of 2005.
Oh, wow.
Needless to say, that didn't happen. The network and the provincial funding agency here and the various people involved have been very good about giving me enough rope to hang myself on and extra time. But because I was working on another project, Fields of Fear, the documentary I did on Fern Belzil, I had to finish that first. So I finished that sort of last year, and I didn't start shooting Best Evidence until May of 2006. I went out to Kansas City to talk to Mac Tonies. It was a great trip, Kansas City to talk to Mac Tonies, Dallas to talk to Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Bailey, who's in the film, in the RB-47 segment, Brad Sparks in California, and Bob Salas, Captain Robert Salas, who from Malmstrom in California, and then back to Washington to talk to Bruce Maccabee and Dick Hall, who lives in Washington, too. So that was the first trip that we took, and then a couple weeks later it was off to England to interview Stuart Miller, and who didn't make the film, unfortunately, left on the cutting room floor.
Ouch.
I emailed Stuart and told him that, and he said, no problem, you know. and to interview Nick Pope, and also go up to Rendlesham Forest, and there's an interesting story about that, too, that maybe we can get into later, goof-ups in production, or post-production. That's how it sort of happened. The germination for the, sorry, you asked me how did it all come about. Nick Redfern and I were sitting around one night getting drunk, and Redfern bet me that I couldn't raise enough money to do a film about a top 10 UFO cases thing. So I took the bet, and Nick now owes me, I think it's $50.
Wow.
No, I'm just kidding. That's not a true story, but I just wanted to mention Nick Redfern.
I really believed that for a moment. I was excited. I was like, that is what's going in the commercial.
There you go.
So.
Well, you can still use it in the commercial because Nick probably won't deny it. He'll think, hey, that's a cool story. I'll use that in my next book.
Oh, boy.
But don't boom. Hey, thank you very much. Hey,
it's folks, turning into a roast here tonight.
if you're listening, folks, it's like the Shatner roast coming up. I've been running on Diet Coke and fumes for like 3 weeks now, sitting on the edge. So I'm wired, which means no holes barred tonight. So everybody gets it, including myself. But that's how it came about. I was sitting down and I'd finished. What was the last UFO film I did before that? Aztec or Do You Believe in Magic? And I was trying to think, well, look, you know, I've done these films. I did a film on Stan, which was really a biography, Stan Friedman. And I did the Magic film, which I then, depending on who you talk to, completely repudiated. And I did the Aztec film, which was basically just a small independent thing. And I said, look, what I'd like to do is try and sell a film, because I take the UFO thing seriously, that just talks about the best cases, because I'm not a crashed flying saucer guy. I don't believe that any of those cases have been even remotely proved to have been UFOs. And I think, and I've said on your show and other shows before, that the last 20 or 30 years, ufology has made a terrible mistake in focusing on two things. Crash flying saucers, government cover-ups thereof, and alien abductions. And I think what they should have been focusing on were the really good cases out there that had solid evidence, good witnesses, things that you could then take forward to science or politicians or whoever, and mobilize maybe some interest in investigating the UFO phenomenon scientifically, or even, I'm not a big, not a fan of the exopolitics movement, of course, but you might even be able to get some serious political interest as opposed to the kind they talk about, by talking about real cases. And that's sort of what motivated me to do the film, and kudos to space, and in particular Charlotte Engel, who's the commissioning person at Space, the Imagination Station, who agreed to let me do the film and gave me the initial pre-license, which allowed me to leverage the other money to do it, because it's not a standard UFO documentary. Space is very much like the Sci-Fi Channel in the U.S. It's sort of the equivalent to our sci-fi. In fact, Space airs a lot of sci-fi programming like Battlestar Galactica and Andromeda, I think, is sci-fi too. So kudos to them for letting me do a film that from, the get-go, I told them was going to be more serious than spooky aliens and abductions and crazy lights. There is a little weird music in it, It is a UFO documentary. But, serious content, serious people talking, and they bought it and let me run with it. So for those people, and you often read them on UFO updates or some of the message boards, who are constantly bemoaning the state of UFO documentaries and how documentary producers and networks are just out to make a fast buck off of people in the UFO field and never properly represent their views. That might be true in some cases, but in my experience, it's never been true with Space here in Canada. They've always been very good about letting me do what I want to do, and good for them. Couldn't do it without them.
Well, I'm excited about seeing this special eventually, because it's good to have someone who's on our side of the UFO, pro-UFO folks, making the movie. We know it's almost in-house, if you will. It's not produced by some outsider who doesn't know a Friedman from a Nori.
Yeah, well, there's a difference. It's very odd, because one of the reasons why I came close to having a nervous breakdown while making this film is, I do take the UFO phenomenon seriously outside of the filmmaking business. Like, leave aside the fact that I make films about anything. Just as a person, it's an interest of mine. So while it's not a life-defining interest, as some people have suggested, if UFOs, somebody told me I couldn't do anything with UFOs ever again as of tomorrow, life would happily proceed along for me. It wouldn't be the end of my existence. But it is something I take seriously, and that's probably rare. I'm sure there are other filmmakers, certainly in the underground world where people show up at conferences and their little DV cams and make quote-unquote films, those people take UFOs seriously. But in the world of professional filmmakers, I'm one of the very few, maybe the only one, I don't know, who has also turned himself into some sort of UFO commentator, researcher, whatever. So, besides wanting to make a good film that would please the network and that would please viewers, and believe me, the UFO subculture, and it is a subculture, is teeny tiny. So, you cannot make a film for just ufology people. You have to make a film that will be appealing to people who don't really know anything about ufology, people who can't tell Stan Friedman from George Norrie. But I had the extra added pressure of also wanting to make a film that would, as much as possible, satisfy the people who are interested in the serious study of the UFO phenomenon, which includes me. So there's probably factual errors in the film. You know, I probably missed something. But I, you know, tore what little hair I have left out trying to make sure that there were as few factual errors or goofs as possible. So I would spend hours, you know, during the evening poring over these things and saying, is this right? And researching, and is this right? Did I get this right? And writing the script for it, because it's a completely scripted documentary. The interviews, you plug them in. They're not scripted, but you fit them into the script so that the story of each case moves along. Writing the script was, it's the first time I've ever done a doc like that with extensive narration. And, you know, it was a challenging sort of thing. So yeah, you know, it, part of the reason why it took so long is, well, the largest part of the reason, I suppose, why it took so long is because I was so, anal retentive and perfectionist about it. And that's why we're so close, like today, just delivering today, you know, even up till the bitter end this afternoon with the courier coming, I was saying to the online editor, look, we've got to fix that. And he's looking at me going, well, yeah, we don't really have time to fix it. And I said, no, I can't send it out like this. I want to fix it. And so we did. And we just barely made the courier deadline to get it out this afternoon.
Wow.
So I'm insane. That I have a number of friends who think I'm clinically insane. I've gone completely mad. You know, maybe they're right. So
I've been mildly concerned because you've been telling people about Stan Friedman's Coast to Coast appearance at The Other Side of Truth now for like the last 10 days, and I'm like, oh shit, Kimmel's really off the deep end now.
Yeah, well, I did. It is true. You know, the blog updates, I didn't even, normally I'd put an on hiatus thing up. I've been sleeping in the office. You know, on the couch, which is too small for me. I even slept on the floor a couple of nights because the couch was too small, and just kind of working 24/7. And, you know, boo hoo, poor me. I'm not looking for sympathy or anything. You know, wow, Paul, what a hero. No. It's just, it was an incredibly draining process. And, it sort of, you know, not just on the professional end of it, but the personal end of it too. It's I've never experienced a film project. I've done television series before and other films, both about UFOs and not UFOs. And I've never experienced a film that has impacted not only on my professional life so much, but on my personal life too. And not always in a good way, and that's all I'll say about that. But, you know, it's been a really, the last 3 weeks have been hellish. There's no other way, for me, there's no other way to describe it. I'm glad it's over, and I hope folks like the film, because, you know, it's the most personal film I've ever made, which sounds odd for a film that's basically a top 10 film. You know, you don't think top 10 films are very personal. There's tons of top 10 actresses, top 10 Jennifer Aniston, you know, crybaby stories or something. They're all over the place. But for me, this was an extremely personal film for a lot of reasons, not all of which had to do with the film. And, you know, it took a lot out of me. And, I really hope folks like it because there's a lot of me invested in it. So, and if they don't like it, I don't want to hear from them. You know, talk to somebody else.
That's our policy here at Banal of America Audio too. So
it's only on Banal of America that I would bare my soul. You know, if I was on Coast to Coast, I'd be deadly serious with George and talk about just cases and then mock his callers. But on Banal of America, I will bare my soul tonight or
there
whatever.
You go. Now let's talk about the process by which you determined these top 10. Now when you listed them, they're ranked, right? This isn't just an arbitrary list of 10. And if so, how did you come about determining what the top 10 was?
Okay, there's one caveat that I'll put at the beginning before I say anything. And the caveat is that I always retained the right as the guy making the film to jigger the list if I had to, simply because it's television. And you could, for instance, have a case that might have slipped in the top 10 that was just unfilmable. That was always possible. That wasn't terribly interesting from a, you know, and as Dick Hall said to me when he gave me his list, that Paul, this isn't my top 10 list. It's a 10 of the best because I, you know, there's like 50 really good cases that I could have put in the top 10, but here's 10 that I like. And he's quite right. So really it's best evidence, 10 of the best UFO sightings, because frankly, there were 70 cases that got votes altogether. And while I don't think all of them were particularly strong, you know, at least 20 or 30 of them could easily have been in the top 10 in terms of good, solid cases that deserve to be looked at. So, having said that, with a caveat, what I did was I polled or surveyed a group of UFO experts, Stan Friedman, Kevin Randall, Carl Flock before he died, Nick Redfern, Bruce McAbee, Dick Hall, they're all listed in the film, a bunch of others too, and Brad Sparks? I think I did, yeah. Nick Pope, Don Ledger here in Canada, others, Will Wise, the curator of the Project Blue Book Archive, a whole long list. And I said, look guys, give me your top 10 list. And so they did. I only had, of the people I asked, I only had two turn me down. And I won't mention their names, and that's fine. Everybody else was eager and keen to participate. And then what I did was I ranked them. So if you gave me a list, and you know, case number 10, I gave 1 point. Mm-hmm. Case number 9, I gave 2, and so on until case number 1 got 10. And then you'd push all the cases together, and the cases that had the most point, generally speaking, are in the film and in their proper places, with maybe one or two exceptions. And the top 5 cases are definitely boing, boing, boing. Those were the 5. From 6 till 10, there might have been a teeny tiny little bit of movement for various reasons. In fact, there was a teeny tiny little bit of movement for various reasons. And one of the cases that would have been in the top 10, i.e. number 10, was bumped out. And a case was brought in at number 10 for a very specific reason, which we can talk about, next or whatever. That's the only real change that I made. I don't think off the top, I think everything else was pretty much above board. But I did make that one change, and there was a very specific reason for it, and that's the Nuremberg case. The Nuremberg case didn't receive enough votes to make the top 10. But I'm a firm believer in letting people know that the UFO phenomenon is not something that has just started happening in 1947. The UFO phenomenon has been something in different ways, shapes, and forms that has been with us for hundreds or even thousands of years. And I thought it was, and I had a couple of people who submitted their top 10 lists who said, look, you know, you should pay attention to this, that this is important. I thought it was important that there should be a case from pre-1947 that represented all cases and would allow me through narration to make the point that the UFO phenomenon is not a new phenomenon, that this is something that has been with us for a very long time. And so that's why Nuremberg made the list. And if people want to beat me over the head because case number 10 didn't make it because Nuremberg got put in besides, that's fine, let them beat me over the head. And they can call it the top 9 UFO sightings. But I thought that was an important point to make, and that was the UFO researcher in me that wanted to make it. And I also think it makes for a better story in terms of the film to indicate that prolonged sort of history of the UFO phenomenon. So I thought it was perfectly valid to stick Nuremberg in and to exercise my editorial discretion to move one case out and put Nuremberg in its place. So that's the change that I made.
How much of this process did you try and explain at the beginning? Because I'm sure that must have been tricky, or did you just be like, these are the top 10 cases, let's start with number 10. You know, like, how did you tackle that sort of issue as a filmmaker?
You mean in the film itself?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you what's the, here it is. Here's the opening narration. Chris does a much better job of it than I do, but in 2005 and 2006, documentary filmmaker Paul Kimball surveyed a select group of the world's leading UFO researchers. He asked each of them for a list of their 10 best UFO cases of all time. The cases were assigned point values based on the rank and then averaged together. Over 70 UFO incidents from around the world received votes. At the end of the process, the following 10 incidents comprised the best evidence, UFO cases, of all time. And then it goes right into case number 10, which is Nuremberg. And while that's happening, while she's reading the narration and doing the voiceover, images from the various cases pop up.
Nice.
So it goes from the opening credits right till that, and then boom, you're right into the top 10 cases, and that pretty much takes you all the way through to the film until the closing narration, and then that's followed by a final comment, which I gave, and I thought this was important too. You know, most the people commenting, Stan Friedman, Dick Hall, they're the older guys. Even Brad Sparks is in his, I think, 50s now. Nick Pope was the youngest, and Nick is, I think, 42 or 43.
What about Tunney's?
Well, there you go. I thought it was important that the last word be given to the guy or one of the guys who I think is going to be the voices of the next generation. So the previous generation, or the current one, in the case of, say, Nick Pope or those guys, are all throughout the film. But I left the final word in the film, sort of the voice of the future, to Mac Tonies. Could easily have been Nick Redfern or somebody like Will Wise, but Mac is the guy I interviewed. And Mac has the final word on what the what we should be doing, why the UFO phenomenon is important, and why should we, science and all the rest of us should pay attention to it. And I thought, just like it was important to put the Nuremberg case in at number 10 to illustrate the time, you know, the prolonged nature of the phenomenon, I thought it was important, and again, this is the UFO guy in me, to give Tony's the final word and to say, folks, look, here's a young guy who's interested in UFOs and has some pretty thought-provoking things to say about it. And the same thing is true, again, although you didn't ask, why I have Chris McBride narrating the film, besides the fact that I think she's the most talented actress I've ever run across. She's young. She's 23. And she's a woman. Those are two things you don't see a lot of in ufology, you know, women and young people. So I thought it was important to try and give a voice to the film that wasn't just, this is case number 7, you know, the typical, stereotypical narrative voice that you hear in a lot of documentaries, both UFOs and non-UFO docs. It's probably the same guy. It's like going to films and seeing the opening credit roll or what's coming, and in the Land of Oz or something like that. And I thought, look, I want a different voice here. I want to end it with Mac, and I want somebody narrating this who I think, A, is talented and can do the job, but, you know, is a woman and is young. And let's make it a little different. And that was a risky thing to do, I was told by some people in the industry. Sorry, that's an in-joke. And it's not really a joke. It's one of those stressful things that almost gave me my nervous breakdown. But I stuck to my guns on that, and, you know, we'll see how it turns out. I think it turned out great. And it's a new voice, a new way of hearing the UFO story being told.
Yeah.
So good.
Young people and women in ufology. That sounds a lot like Ben All of America.
Well, I'm willing to admit that, you know, maybe I was a little inspired by Ben All of America.
Just to share my end of the thing here, I've had quite a long weekend myself, so I think this is going to be a very fast and loose special Kimball of Canada. This is, I guess, when I get to play Jay Leno in a sense, because I'm going to ask you what constitutes a best case. But before we do that, let's take a listen to a clip from Best Evidence, Nick Pope talking about what he thinks constitutes a best case.
The best UFO cases are obviously the ones where you've got more than just someone's story, where you've got some sort of corroborative evidence that can be looked at in a proper scientific way. Now, that corroboration, it might be a photo or a video. It could be radar, or it could be trace evidence from a landing.
So there you go. That was a little snippet of Nick Pope. That part actually didn't make the special. Paul informed me that it's going to be in the extra bonus stuff on the DVD when it comes out. But there you get an idea of what's one of the experts who contributed to the special thinks constitutes a best case. Now we're going to talk to the man, of course, who made the film on what he thinks constitutes a best case. Paul, what's the perfect storm of elements that needs to come together to really put a case near the top 10 or in the top 10?
Sure, and I'll tell folks, I submitted a top 10 list myself. I polled myself, as it were, which actually sounds rather risque when you think about it.
Yeah.
let's say I surveyed. No, there's no good way to say it. I submitted my own top 10 list, and I went with my own criteria. The RB-47 case was my number one case. It's not even close, the other cases. They're all a lot of really good cases, don't get me wrong. But the RB-47 case is the perfect storm of UFO cases, which is why, despite Phil Klass's attempts and the attempts of other skeptics and debunkers to debunk the case over the years, they've failed woefully because it can't be done. It's an unexplainable case. Nobody's been able to crack it yet, unidentified. And what you have there are quality witnesses. So you've got an RB-47 spy plane flying along, and you've got the pilot and the co-pilot and the navigator up front, who are the, you know, among the creme de la creme of U.S. Air Force crews. These are guys who flew literally wing to wing with Soviet MiGs that would fly over Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. That kind of thing. These guys, you know, nerves of steel sort of thing. In fact, in the film, there's a point where we talk a bit about Major Lew Chase, Lewis Chase, who was the pilot of the RB-47 in that incident. And he landed, there's this great story, he landed a plane, let me see if I get this right, the tail or one of the wings had fallen off on takeoff. And he brought the plane in with no fatalities. There's a newspaper article about that in the film, and Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Bailey, who flew on the RB-47s, was our key witness, or not key witness, but one of our key experts on the plane itself and the crew. He knew these guys. And he said, look, you know, these were the best of the best. The three Ravens, which is the name they had for the electronic countermeasure warfare officers who would sit in the belly of the plane and run all the high-tech spy gear. He said those three guys, two of them trained him. They were so good and so highly respected that they were broken up as a crew and put in three different crews so they could train more people. In short, what you have, first of all, is six of the best airmen you can put up in the sky in terms of pilots, navigators, observers, but also in terms of the guys working the electronic warfare gear in the guts of the plane. And it was a spy plane. Here's number two. It's a spy plane, so they had the most technically advanced gear of the time, at their time, for picking things up. These were guys who were basically sent up to try and detect new Soviet signals and all that sort of stuff. They were there to spy on the Soviets. So you've got a highly advanced plane, you've got six of the best people you could possibly find doing it, you have a visual sighting by the pilots, it's a prolonged sighting, so it's not like, you know, 3 seconds by the town drunk, it's took place over a period of 2 or 3 hours over a very large space, you know, from the Gulf of Mexico up through to Oklahoma. It was tracked not only by the plane's gear, but by ground radar in Texas. Military ground radar in Texas tracked it as well. So now you've got two independent trackings of this object. And as Brad Sparks points out, I think he's right, although I wouldn't bet my life on it, but he says it, and I think this is true. It's the only time in history, these RB-47 cases, where not only would we paint them, i.e. our radar would go out and go, ping, there's something out there, but they received a signal back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which is not often talked about when people talk about the RB-47 case. And Brad makes that point in the film, and that's why he thinks it's the best case of all time as well. In fact, the RB-47 case was so far ahead in the voting of other cases, it could almost be like, you know, best evidence, 9 extremely good cases, and then the RB-47 case kind of thing. It's very highly thought of. And the shame of it is, very few people outside of ufology or the UFO research community know about it. You could walk down the street in New York and mention Roswell. Most people would probably go, Roswell, vaguely heard of it, sure. You'd mention the RB-47 case and their eyes would glaze over and go, what? And that, to me, has been the problem with ufology for 30 years. They've focused on something like Roswell instead of trying to make the case using cases like RB-47 or Tehran. Similar thing where you have the 1976 Iranian jet fighter case, highly trained pilots in the Imperial Iranian Air Force, two different planes going out. It's sighted by multiple witnesses on the ground. The pilots see it. It impacts their plane, basically shuts down their plane systems. They have to turn away. I mean, it's just so much good stuff in it. So to answer your question, what makes a good UFO case, a best evidence case? Multiple independent witnesses. That's a really good start, and that's what the Yukon case has, for instance, and that's all it has. But a case like RB-47 is so good because it has not only that, but it also has radar tracking, it has multiple radar trackings from independent sources, the quality of the witnesses. It's the kind of case that I don't understand. You often hear scientists say, well, you know, witness accounts aren't very good scientific evidence, which I think is bollocks, frankly, but I understand where they're coming from, too. Science is not, you know, witness testimony is the weakest form of evidence. It is. I would always rather have the proverbial smoking gun than a witness account. Most lawyers would, or judges, or juries. However, when you can take the witness accounts and do one of two things. A, they're multiple independent witnesses, meaning 3 people saw it here, 4 people who didn't know those 3 people saw the same thing over there, then there's 5 people over here who saw it, that's what happened in Yukon, that's a good case. Or you can back up the witness testimony with some sort of other data. And that's what you get in cases like Tehran, you get it in a case like RB-47, you get it in a case like McMinnville, where you have photos. that back up what the trends were saying, and you can analyze, as Bruce McAbee and Brad Sparks and others have done, the photographs. And we talk about that in that segment. So those are the kinds of cases that people should be talking about. And there you go. There's 10 cases there, folks. And if you can disprove 9 of them, guess what? You're still left with one unidentified flying object case that you can't disprove. And in that case, you should be taking it seriously.
There you go. Now, I was in line with what you're saying here. I was kind of surprised the Malmstrom Air Force Base sighting came in at number 7. I expected that to come in higher because I kind of foresaw your answer to what constituted a best case, and I figured that with considering it was around the Air Force Base. Now, I'll admit, I'm not an expert on and really any of these 10 cases. I know some of them pretty well, and I know some of them fairly well, and some of them I just heard of the first time you sent me the list. But I figured that the Malmstrom Air Force Base sighting, due to, you know, the high quality, I guess you could say, of the witnesses, would put it up higher. Why do you think it didn't come in as high, or is it just sort of an anomaly?
I don't know. There's a number of cases that take place around nuclear missile bases. The Minot Air Force Base case, for instance, was profiled in the Peter Jennings film, Seeing is Believing, and they did a very good job of it. Even if that case had made the top 10 list, I might not have put it in simply because Jennings had already done about as good a job as you could do on it. So why not profile another very good missile-based case and make the point? So it's kind of like saying, you know, if you want to vote for the best professional wrestler of all time, you know, maybe Bret Hart and Owen Hart split the vote, I don't know, for the Hart family or something. That's a bad example, but whatever. If you've got two teams in the same city, like New York used to have the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Giants, three teams, you know, instead of having all New Yorkers cheer for one team, they sort of split it up. The same thing might have happened, and I think it did, in the missile-based cases. So, you know, Malmstrom maybe gets some votes, but other people vote for Minot Air Force Base, and other people vote for maybe another case.
Okay.
And that might be why maybe it didn't rank higher. The problem with Malmstrom, too, is a lot of people think it's just Captain Salas. He's the only witness. So you really just got Bob Salas's account of what happened at Oscar Flight. Echo Flight is fairly well detailed in documents, but there's affidavit evidence. We don't talk about this in the film. We only had so much time. But, you know, there were other people involved who have come forward. It's not just Bob Salas. So we have Bob Salas and not these other people, but there are other people out there. I think, though, that's a bit of a misperception by some people in the UFO community that Malmstrom either stands or falls on Bob Salas's word, and that's not the case. So maybe that's why it didn't get maybe higher up in the list. On the other hand, there's a very easy answer. You could just say the six cases in front of it are better. Or, you know, as good, if not better. I mean, Shag Harbor, it's a great case. Kelly Johnson, great case. You can go down the list. Great case, great case. So it's kind of hard, maybe, you know, it's like, what are the top 10 albums of all time? What? U2's The Joshua Tree only comes in at number 9? Well, yeah. That's because there's 8 other really, 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 really good albums in front of it, although it's still a great album. So I think there's partly that, too. Malmstrom's a great case, but there were 6 cases that maybe were better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's at number 7.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that whole split the vote idea, too, with the missile-based type thing. Like, and to give you a good analogy to use, how about like when an actor's nominated for, he had 2 good roles in the year, and he ends up getting nominated for Academy Awards for both roles, you know, and then they're like, he may not even win the award now because he's going to split the vote.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking of, are 2 actors who are in the same film. So, and that happens every now and then where you get 2 actors in the same film, and they, like, The Departed this year, I think, had, were 2 actors nominated for Best Supporting Actor? Maybe not. But you find films where you, they'll split the vote.
Yeah.
And as a result, some guy comes up the middle and wins Best Supporting Actor or something that you never would have expected. So that kind of thing might have happened a bit too.
Now, I tried to avoid like just being like, tell me about this case, but there was some couple that I did want to note, and, one of them really seemed to stick out like a sore thumb, and that was the Skylab 3 photos, only because that really is atypical of the rest of the cases. The rest of the cases seem a little more classical UFO sighting type cases, but the Skylab one is very different. So let's talk about the Skylab 3 case.
Sure. Skylab 3, 1973, you had 3 astronauts, Alan Bean, Jack Lausma, and Dr. Owen Garriott, who was the first, I think, scientist in space. He wasn't a military guy. He was from Stanford University. And they were bouncing around in Skylab up there, and they observed this object, this bright lighted object out the window, and Garriott took pictures. You can call NASA and they'll send you copies of the pictures. They were very nice. They sent me copies of the pictures, which are in the film. And by the way, anyone who knocks NASA shouldn't knock NASA. NASA was very helpful to us in the making of this film, not only there, but in other areas. So anyway, they took these photos, and then Brad Sparks interviewed Garriott, I think back in the early to mid 1970s, sort of shortly thereafter the case happened, and Garriott did a, you know, you could, for the film makes it clear, you can get a sort of size and distance measurement of how big this object, whatever it was that they saw, by a number of different factors that Brad explains in the film, sort of like tracking. Well, anyway, I'll leave it to the film. Take my word for it, because I'm not an expert, at least in this kind of stuff. And the estimate of the size of the object is between 800 and 1,000 feet in diameter.
Oh, wow.
Now, that's huge. Brad makes the point that there was nothing orbiting the planet Earth that we put up there, at least not like that, that was of that size. I mean, Skylab itself was only about 150 feet in diameter. So this is, if these estimates are accurate, and Brad makes the point, they are estimates, 800 to 1,000 feet. If they're even remotely accurate, you've got this huge object floating around. We have photos of this object, and Brad makes the point that it's one of the very few astronauts, and maybe the only astronaut case, that has never been explained. You know, most of the other ones can be explained. You see little specks of light and stuff. Oh, well, that's a water crystal or an ice crystal or whatever, and it probably is. But the Skylab case, well, very few people, the strange thing is very few people know about it, even in ufology. It's hardly ever talked about. But it's a really good case, and it certainly deserved to be on the top 10 list, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely different. Like you said, I had never really heard about it before, but when I looked into it to do the research for the special, I was like, wow, this is quite a UFO case, and much, much different from, what I had seen from the other cases when I was looking at those.
Well, I sent a video clip of the case to a friend of mine who's an author, not a UFO guy, but interested in science and space exploration and stuff. And I said, look, what do you think of this? And he said, well, you know, it's interesting, but hardly convincing. And I'm sure Dr. Garriott wouldn't agree with some of these statements. And I emailed him back and I said, well, actually, Dr. Garriott's the guy who made the estimates, you know. So I don't know whether Dr. Garriott today thinks aliens are visiting Earth or whatever. All I know is that from what I understand, he still thinks that there's something up there that they can't explain. Anyway, they don't know what it is they saw that day. And to my knowledge, it's never been adequately explained, which is why it's a UFO in our film.
Exactly. And one of the other cases that you already alluded to and teased that we were going to talk about, someone must have slipped you my notes. And that's the Nuremberg case. You slipped in at number 10. Very interesting. Dated to at 1561, which is really an amazing date when you think about it. Over 400 years ago, almost 500 really, if you wait another 50 years. So quite a long time ago. Let's talk about this Nuremberg case, because I had never even heard about it till you sent me the list.
Yeah, the Nuremberg case is interesting. If you look at the history of the UFO phenomenon prior to 1947, there's a large number of representations of things that you could perhaps call UFOs in literature and also in art. Ezekiel's wheel is one of the most famous ones from the Bible. Now, whether Ezekiel's wheel is really a UFO or not, I don't know. But, you know, that's something that at least some people point to and say, well, look, maybe what they saw was a UFO. Reverend Barry Downing wrote the classic book on the Bible and flying saucers, the same idea that a lot of things that you'll find in the Bible, and I've talked to Stan Friedman about this, and he finds it an intriguing idea. A lot of things you might find in the Bible are actually not sort of religious or spiritual manifestations of a god, but are, UFOs, the old ancient astronauts idea to some degree or another. Mm-hmm. Anyway, The Nuremberg case is one of the most interesting ones because it was reported at the time in the Nuremberg Gazette that these people, the people in Nuremberg saw these things, in the sky. And basically, what it's described as is an aerial battle that you have, as Stan would put it, motherships, larger objects, and out of these objects were coming smaller sphere-like objects, and to the people in Nuremberg, it seemed like there was an aerial battle going on. So there's a wood carving that was painted a couple years later, I believe, by a guy named Hans Glaser, and that is the representation of this UFO incident, although there's also the written account from the Nuremberg Gazette. The interesting thing is, a couple of years later, a very similar incident happened, and there's a painting of that too, in Basel, Switzerland, and that painting is in the film to kind of sort of say, look, this is not unique. But the Nuremberg one I find more interesting. If you just look at the painting, there's a lot of stuff going on there. And, you know, were they UFOs, aliens from outer space? I don't know. But, it's, you can't, Don Ledger talks about this in the film. We interviewed him about this case. And he said, you know, did these people know something that we didn't know? You just can't dismiss it because there's so many, cases like this, so many instances where this happened. And one wonders if they had our technology back then, you know, like what we have today, if they had that back then, maybe they would have described it differently, and maybe we'd have a better representation, photos or something, who knows. But something weird, there's no question, something weird happened in the skies over Nuremberg that day, and it does bear many of the hallmarks of modern UFO cases, or at least you can look at it that way. So I thought it was important to put it in the film.
And the last one I wanted to talk to you about was this Tehran case, because as I see here in the list now, it ranked very high, and it's, I guess, fairly well known in ufology. Maybe you would know if it's how well known it is. I've heard of it before, but it doesn't get the star treatment really that some of the other big UFO cases get. But it is pretty solid, and I was intrigued also by the international flavor of that with the U.S. and Iranian sort of both countries having a stake, I guess, in this UFO case. So talk a little bit about the Tehran case, and that's the last one we're going to ask you about specifically.
Sure. The Iranian case, I mean, one of the real reasons why it's not terribly well known, certainly outside ufology, although I think sightings, television show sightings profiled it some years ago and talked to some of the people who were actually involved, the pilots or whatever. So, you know, it has had some media attention in the past. But there's a number of reasons, I think, why it hasn't had as high a profile as Roswell. And again, same thing could be said for pretty much every case that's in the film, including Kelly Johnson, RB-47s, like most people don't know about these cases. And that's because Roswell's sexy, ooh, crash flying saucers, alien bodies, all that kind of bunk, sorry. You know, and instead of talking about cases with good witnesses and good evidence and all that sort of stuff. And if you're a Roswell fan, sorry, but there it is. Although Roswell does make it into the film. To be cheeky, I managed to slide Roswell in for about 5 seconds in a place that, well, anyway, I thought it was kind of, you know, funny just to reference Roswell without actually putting it on the list. But the Iranian case also, it's in Iran. And no offense to you folks south of the border, my good friends and cousins in the United States, but you tend to have a relatively limited worldview sometimes of what the planet's like, and that includes ufology. So Americans tend to focus on American cases. And there is a great big world out there, and one of the things that the points the film makes, including at the end, is this is not an, it doesn't say this specifically, but this is not an American phenomenon. These aren't all these crazy Yanks seeing UFOs in the sky because they're goofy. This is a worldwide phenomenon, not just timeless, but also worldwide. And I think cases like Iran and the Yukon case in 1996, which is very little known in the United States, even Shag Harbor isn't terribly well known in the U.S. I mean, basically, it's one of the great cases of all time. You actually have flying saucers, Stan Friedman's spirit possessed me there for a second. A UFO going down, you've got civilian witnesses, RCMP witnesses, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, you've got a military investigation, and what you have, Don Ledger makes this point, I'm getting off topic, sorry, on Iran, but I just want to make the broader point. In Shag Harbor, what you have is the civilian witnesses initially thought it was an aircraft crashing. saw these lights. It was an aircraft going down. And it was the military who came in and classified it as a UFO. So usually it's the other way around. You'll have the civilians calling and going, hey, we saw a UFO, and the military will come along and give some goofy explanation. And this was the exact opposite. So it's a great case. More people should know about it. But what it's 2007. What are people talking about, Tim? Phoenix Lights, 1997, the 10th year anniversary. Roswell, 1947, the 60th year anniversary. No coincidence, both of those are American cases. How about Shag Harbor, 1967, the 40th anniversary thereof of one of the great cases of all time? Nope, hardly, you don't boo. You're not hearing boo about that, and maybe you won't. But you should be having people like on Nori and other shows talking about Shag instead of just Roswell. But no, doesn't happen because it didn't happen in the United States. And so the same thing happens with the Iranian case and the Yukon case and a lot of other cases. And we make the point at the end that if it had been a top 20 film, you would have seen cases also from France, New Zealand, New Guinea, and Japan, and Brazil. So we would have had five extra countries if it had been a top 20 list. And I think that's important for people to take away, too, that you need to look at the UFO phenomenon as a worldwide phenomenon and really, you know, focus in on cases like Iran, which are really, you know, it's a really, really good case. Anyway, I didn't answer your question, really, about what the case is, but it's a couple of pilots, multiple witnesses on the ground sighting, including military witnesses, F-4 Iranian Air Force jets are scrambled, and this is the Shah's era, not the revolutionary Iran. These were pilots trained by the United States, top pilots, no question, you know, these aren't sort of the stereotypical view you have of non-first world countries where the guys can barely fly their planes right side up or whatever. These are top-notch pilots. And again, there's always that kind of cultural bias, too, against cases that don't happen in the so-called first or Western world. You know, like, oh, well, the witnesses have to be all kind of goofy. It's like the Father Gill case in New Guinea. Well, it was Father Gill and a bunch of the natives, right? Well, you often hear some people say, well, how much can you really rely on the natives? Well, for Pete's sake. You know, I thought that kind of colonialist attitude sort of went flying out the window when the British Empire was dismantled or whatever, but it still exists somewhere. And so I can understand why sort of second and third world countries get ticked off at us in the West sometimes when we have this sort of looking down on them attitude, but that's a different story. But it happens in ufology, too, and the Iranian case maybe has suffered a bit of that over the years as well. But you've got these multiple witnesses, military, civilian witnesses. Two planes get scrambled at different times to go can deal with this, whatever they're seeing, and both planes get their systems zonked out. Sort of, I'm giving you the short story here. Mm-hmm. And as they approach the object, as they turn away from the object, their systems come back on. One of the planes thought it was under attack, so it tried to lock on with a Sidewinder missile. No way. Weapon systems went down. And, you know, it's a prolonged sighting. Again, it takes place over a period of time, during the evening. And quality witnesses again. So you've got a lot of different data going in there. And a thorough investigation, and paper written on it by Bruce McAbee. You know, it's just a really good case.
Yeah.
And one of the other reasons maybe why it got lost in the shuffle is, you know, Iran, the Shah's regime fell 3 years later. And so, you know, a lot of other things were going on in Iran that maybe were of more importance to some people than the UFO case.
Oh,
so maybe
geez.
It got lost in that shuffle, too.
Exactly. Just to continue the theme of patting myself on the back, we'll have Chris Stiles on soon on the program, probably by the end of May, to talk about the Shag Harbor UFO case. So there's some programs out there that are hip to the anniversary of the Shag Harbor incident.
In all of America, where do you get your ideas?
That was a suggestion.
Work.
Actually, let's be honest. That was a Kimball suggestion.
But to be fair, you asked me, you know, who I might suggest as a good Canadian guest.
That's true.
So I think I gave you Chris and Don Ledger's name, and I said, you know, Chris, Don gets a lot of attention, and rightly so, but Chris maybe gets less attention, and he's a top-notch researcher of just UFOs in general. Great guy, very loquacious, a lot of good info. So that'll, folks, tune in. That you might not have heard of Chris Stiles, but that's going to be a BOA show that you definitely want to tune into.
Definitely. And to throw back to your point here about the international flavor of the special, I actually noted here four cases from the U.S., one in Germany, one in the U.K., one in Iran, two in Canada and one in parts unknown. That's my wrestling background at heart, and that would be the space one, I guess you'd say, Skylab 3 photos. We'll classify that as parts unknown almost.
Sort of inner, you know, space, but I think, as I recall, Skylab was at that point orbiting the Earth somewhere over the Indian Ocean. So you could call that an Indian case if you want to, just, you know, a couple hundred miles up or whatever.
All right, I prefer parts unknown. But
there you go. Yeah. From parts unknown, the Skylab 3K.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, so there's quite an international flavor, and you kind of already spoke to the point I was going to make here that you know the special tries to get across that you know this is an international phenomenon. And then to sort of also throw to looking at some of these trends here from the cases, you got three from the 50s, two in the 60s, two in the 70s, one in the 80s, one in the 90s, and of course the Nuremberg one we talked about. Let's throw that one out
right.
from this question. It seems like obviously it's a downward momentum. What do you think that is? Just that as you know, it's harder to get good cases from the 90s and the 80s because it's so recent and, the witnesses haven't come out yet and they haven't surfaced yet. Or is it that the actual overall, you know, pool of potential sightings is down so much that we can't get a good sighting?
I think there's a number of factors in there. One, because of the people I polled, you know, they've been researching, say, a case like RB47 for years. So the longer a case exists, the more you can drill down into the data and interview witnesses and all that sort of thing. So there's a familiarity with it. There's no question about that. On the other hand, you could say, look, Malmstrom happened in 1967, but it didn't really surface until the 1990s, I believe. So in a sense, even though it happened 40 years ago, it's a relatively recent development. The same thing is true, even though Shag Harbor was known in 67, there were a lot of newspaper articles, it kind of then sort of disappeared until Don and Chris resurrected it in the 1990s. So these were guys who were going back and looking at older cases. And I think that's just a natural development. I'll put my historian's hat on now. I think that's a natural kind of thing, that it can take a while for historical developments to become apparent, for all the files to become released, or at least a number of the files, for witnesses to, you know, to do the groundwork. Mm-hmm. It's like when the O'Hare case happened a couple of months ago. Several months ago now. And everybody, when it first became public in January, everybody and their dog, well, widely public, I should say, everybody and their dog was jumping on this and saying, well, this is it. This is the greatest case of all time, blah, 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 blah. And I mean, no. Call me in 20 years after it's been, like, it's the world we live in now where it's all, you know, me, 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 give it to me now, now, now. I blame music videos for this, the way they programmed kids, but it slipped through into, it's like fast cut television. You're a wrestling fan, Tim. You and I can understand this. 10, 15 years ago, you know, you'd watch a really good wrestling match where they'd tell a story and there'd be a lot of what we would call today boring holds and stuff. Now it's, you got to jump off the top rope every 5 seconds or, you know, people tune out.
Yeah.
And that's a bad way of looking at important issues. It permeates our politics, it permeates our culture, it permeates the entertainment industry, and it permeates the UFO phenomenon. And so you get a case like O'Hare pops up and, excuse me, it's the big thing. Well, you know, no. Like, who knows? Already that case seems to be sort of fading away, and we'll see what the NARCAP investigation brings forward. Maybe it's a good case, maybe it's not. But these cases in the past, those are ones that have been thoroughly vetted and investigated, and the data is all out there. And so it makes it, those are the cases that I think you're more comfortable with. Because you can say, look, people have looked at this. The Air Force, civilian investigators can't explain it. Ergo, that's a good UFO case. O'Hare? Well, you know, it hasn't really been looked at, so maybe not. The interesting thing is, because it's the 10th year anniversary of the Phoenix Lights case, you might think the Phoenix Lights would have polled very high. And yet, apparently, the UFO experts that I interviewed don't think very highly of the Phoenix Lights case, or at least not in the context of, is it one of the great cases of all time, which a lot of people in the media seem to think it is. And yet, I think the Phoenix, it was on the list, you know, sort of the top 70. I think it came in at number 48 or something.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was really far down the list. Very few people voted for it at all. Those that did might have stuck it at number 8 or 9. You know, if I'd sent Dr. Lynn Cate a note, I'm sure she would have put it higher, you know, number 1. But she might have had trouble finding another 9 cases to stick on there. I don't know how much research she's done beyond just Phoenix Lights.
Ouch.
The Well, no.
No, you don't have to. Take that out.
I don't mean that to be a flag on Lynn Katai. I just, you know, she's associated with the Phoenix Lights. How much research, really in-depth research, has she done into other cases? I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
Brad Sparks is very closely associated with the RB-47 case, but I can tell you, Brad Sparks is intimately familiar with just about every other case that's out there. So Dick Hall the same way. Dick Hall is well known for working on some of the NICAP cases like Socorro, Trindade, but he also is extremely well versed in all of the other cases. Nick Pope, very closely tied to Rendlesham. But also very knowledgeable about a wide array of cases. So this, and Bruce McAbee, New Zealand, and Tehran, but also obviously Bruce is very, et cetera, Don with Shag Harbor. So those are the people whose opinions really count, the ones who not only look at their pet cases and flog that, but then really investigate and become familiar with all of the other cases that are out there as well. And those are the people that that I wanted to interview, and those people don't think very highly, at least in the context of putting forward a top 10 list of cases, of the Phoenix Lights case. So for whatever that's worth, oddly enough, the case that very few people know about, the 1996 Yukon case, obviously made the top 10, number 9. Number 8. Mm-hmm. And, you wouldn't think, wow, Phoenix Lights happened a year later. Phoenix Lights isn't on the list. Yukon is. What the heck's going on there? Well, who knows, you know? Maybe it's a better case. But Phoenix happened in the U.S. and the Yukon case happened in the middle of nowhere up in the Yukon. So, it didn't get a whole lot of media attention.